to this Squitty Politi 1 hour special, and I'm very pleased to say that Green Gartside is alongside. It's good to see you, sir.
Hi, Gary. After all this time.
I know. It's been quite a while. In fact, the last time, folks, that that we saw each other was when we were cutting a swathe across the airwaves back in about 1983, 84.
That'd be about right, yeah.
I was working on another radio station at the time, and what I do remember is that I'd just come back after a bout of illness. And I can remember that you'd had the same thing that I'd had, which up until that time, you know, I hadn't sort of found anyone else who'd sort of suffered from it. A thing called colitis.
Right, yes.
And which we won't go into.
No, there's no need
graphically.
To go.
No.
Get the endoscope out.
No, exactly. But I can always remember that you'd sort of told me at the time that you'd sort of suffered from it.
I used to get that kind of problem quite a lot.
Yeah.
But fortunately, along with lots of other things, that's behind
me. We came through, quite literally. We came through the other side,
yes.
Didn't we? But we started this 1 hour special by going back to 1984, and that was a number 10 hit for Squitty Politi back in that year. Of course, that was Woodbees. Open brackets, Pray Like Aretha Franklin. Close brackets. Now, you know, regular listeners to this program will know that, you know, I'm always interested to hear, you know, the stories of the writing and recording of the songs that we play. What kind of sort of memories do you have of that? Now, you know, we should just remind people as well that I think I'm right in saying that was produced by the legendary Arif Mardin, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I'd just gone over to New York. Up until that point, I'd been playing kind of indie rock stuff in London. And I got kind of tired of that. And I was getting more and more into listening to R&B and less into what was becoming very formulaic indie music. And there was a couple of albums I particularly liked that Chaka Khan had made in, I guess they would have been the early 80s. And Arif had produced those. And, of course, he'd worked with Wexler and Dowd on some classic R&B stuff. Including Aretha's work. And when the major record company kind of came and said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I want to go to New York and make, you know, sophisticated R&B stuff. And my wish came true. And it was that was a very steep learning curve for me, though, because I went straight from kind of only knowing three chords and being a bit vague about how things were done to playing with some of the best players in the world, and it kind of freaked me out to begin with, but it worked.
And what about the writing of that song as well? I mean, what would have been the you know, the inspiration for it lyrically?
I'd have to remember what how the lyrics go, and I don't, because I never listen to my own music once it's finished. You know, I never really want to hear it again. But obviously there would have been there was references to Aretha. I was obviously hugely into getting, because when
did
I grew up,
did you get to meet her, Green?
I never met Aretha.
Connection.
I did get quite illegally, really. He did get the old master tapes out, which he had to smuggle out of Atlantic, and let us listen to, you know, that, which was pretty amazing. He might even have let us sample something off one of them, but my memory's a bit vague about that. And no, I met and worked with Chaka Khan and lots of other people around that time. But Aretha I didn't meet. But she was a great, you know, a great influence on me. Because when I was growing up in South Wales, all I listened to was white pop music. I was really into pop music, but I only knew kind of like British white stuff. And I didn't come to listening to any, like, either Jamaican music, African music, Black American music, till my 20s, really. That's when I started getting into it.
And what about that period as well? You know, that kind of sort of initial success, you know, with singles like that. And, you know, of course, you know, the album, what was it?
Cupid and Psyche.
Yeah. I mean, did you enjoy that sort of success at that time and everything that went along with it?
Not especially. I can remember thinking it was very interesting. It was, you know, because I'd never imagined that music would be a career for me. It was something. I was an art student, and the Clash, the Damned, the Pistols and the Heartbreakers came to my college and played, and overnight that was it. I didn't want to do art anymore. I didn't want to do anything. I just wanted to be in a band. But you didn't really think of it as making a living or anything. And then Peel played, you know, the first couple of songs, and then we got asked to support the Clash, and I'd only written three songs, and so suddenly it all looked a bit more serious. And I thought, well, this is just interesting, you know, let's just see what happens. And it was interesting to kind of play around with the whole pop thing. It was the beginning, like, of MTV and all that stuff. And to begin with, it was fun, and thought-provoking, and then it became, I really became very uncomfortable with it all.
We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but, you know, we're here to celebrate, you know, this marvellous new album, and it really is, folks, you know, a great album, one of my favourite albums so far of this year. It's released on the 29th of this month, and it's entitled White Bread, Black Beer. You're kind of sort of happy with the way that, you know, things are going at the moment, you know, because, of course, you played live in London, you know, a few weeks back at the Lumiere, which is an upstairs of a pub, I think I'm right in saying, in Kilburn.
Yeah, nice place, actually. I'd stopped playing live 20-odd years ago, and because I used to get panic attacks. And I remember the last gig I did was with a gang of four in Brighton, and I ended up in hospital because I thought I was having a heart attack.
Was that then, been before going on stage or after coming off?
That was on that occasion, it was after coming off. But by that point, you know, my general state of nervous anxiety was kind of perpetual. I was like always like worried and anxious about
a man after my own heart. So, I did this for so much in common.
And then so I thought, well, sod this, I won't play live anymore. And when in America, of course, with the beginning of MTV and everything and so many radio stations, we just did tons of promotion and going around the country and shaking people's hands, and that kind of robbed my soul of any dignity that I might have had left, and I kind of gave up for a while.
Yeah. But the show at the Lumiere
was great fun.
Yeah.
It was great fun. I finally, I guess with the passing of time, it's one of the many things I can, you know, recommend about getting older, is that you care, you know, you don't panic so much. I mean, what's the worst that could happen? You know what I mean? So it went well. I enjoyed it. I've got a whole, you know, new band together from my beloved Hackney, and I'm looking forward to doing lots more.
Good. Okay, so things are good, and as you're going to hear, folks, as well, you're going to hear four examples of this, you know, marvellous new collection from Skritti. And let's start with, you know, the song that, you know, opens the proceedings that the curtain drops on, and this is going to be a single as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the story behind this one, the Boom Boom Bap?
It's basically about how much I loved hip-hop. In all the years when I didn't make music and I kind of kept myself to myself, the one thing that I would always do, I went back to Wales and lived on my own in a cottage, but I would make regular trips up to London or Bristol to buy hip-hop. And that was my great, great passion. I'd always loved hip-hop from back in the day. And it's just a song, really, about falling in love with hip-hop.
We heard drop. Oh, Papa, don't stop. Bittersweet about life. You know the barroom bells, well, they're calling. You know that perfume smells like blood. If hooks could kill, singing dollar dollar bill, well, that's the beat of my life. I take a double kick, a Jimmy Chang lick. Well, that's the beat of my heart. I come again, cut. I'm telling you what, that's the bitterest part. Well, they've fallen, and Juice joined Jane, got high. If hooks could kill, singing dollar dollar bill on the street of my heart. Got belly wash blood in my heart. star.
BBC London 94.9. It's a Squidgy-Pility 1 hour special, and Green is my very special guest, and a fine example there of what you can expect from the excellent new album, White Bread, Black Beer, and that's going to be a single. That's the album's opener. That's entitled The Boom Boom Bap. You mentioned a little bit earlier on about growing up in South Wales, and initially, you know, you said it would have been, you know, white pop music that you would have connected with. What kind of artists are we talking about?
Well, it was interesting. It started off when I was very little, the Beatles and everything. You know, I can remember asking for a record player for my 8th birthday and asking to, for a subscription to the NME at my 9th birthday, which was a bit ludicrous.
You but, started early, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I did start early. But then it was all kind of chart pop. That's what I knew and liked. And then I kind of got a bit older and would start listening to Peel and stuff. And, like, he was really so important to me, as he was to millions of us. And one of the things about Peel, although later started playing reggae and stuff, when I started listening to him, it wasn't a lot of black music that he played, to be perfectly honest. You know, there wasn't, he never played R&B, he didn't play funk much, as I recall. And so there was, it was just a huge gap in my education that I didn't really get till I moved to London and then on to the States.
But you mentioned about being at Leeds, because you went to Leeds Poly, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to Leeds
initially
Poly
to sort of study art.
Yeah.
And then what, the Anarchy Tour
was
arrived in town.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what kind of, you know, what memories do you have of that evening? I mean, it sounds like it was a pretty pivotal evening in your life,
it
really,
was,
and changed
completely.
Your direction,
it
didn't
was.
It?
I don't, I guess there aren't many evenings like that in people's lives where it's hard to imagine the force, just how much it impacted on me, and how utterly convinced I was within a, you know, half an hour to an hour that I wanted to change my entire life, that I didn't want to go and do any further education again. They had me lined up to do an MA somewhere in studies, cultural studies in Birmingham or something, and I just wasn't interested. You know, I just couldn't wait to blow the last of the money that we had. We lived with in a kind of student house, and we used to get grants back in those days. We blew the last of it on a drum kit and a bass guitar, and we couldn't really play, and it was just absolute. And then the Clash album came out, and I don't know, I was utterly subsumed. I mean, you know, completely driven, taken over, and I have no regrets, you know, but it's been fantastic ever since.
And then what, moved down to London? Am I right in saying that you guys, because there was like a loose collective, wasn't there, based in Camden?
Yeah, we squatted in Camden and on a street called Carroll Street that had a lot of interesting people squatting there, and some fascinating times. And we had kind of kept an open house, which would meant we put our address and everything on the first singles that we did, so people would just come and knock the door, you know, and it would be Dutch anarchists would be there, six of them or something, or public school boys from Brighton that had run away, you know. I mean, it was, you never knew what was going to happen. It was absolutely fantastic. Pretty exhausting after a few years of it, and but they were fantastic, magic years, yeah.
And what about musically as well? Because you know, what would have been sort of, you know, going into the melting pot then? I mean, would there have been sort of reggae? Sort
yeah,
of, you
reggae
know, going
was the
in
big
there?
Thing. Reggae was, well, even back, you know, like, as you know, and that's what punks listened to, was reggae. So you go down places like the Roxy and that's, you know, Don Letts would be there, and you'd listen to reggae and start buying it at there was one shop in Camden that sold it, and we got completely into reggae, and it was really then through reggae into funk and hip hop, and that all started in those Camden years.
But what was it that sort of you know, kind of inspired that you know, I guess sort of philosophy sort of changed, really, because, you know, as you mentioned earlier on, I mean, you know, I mean, you were kind of sort of indie darlings, I suppose, you know, at that time.
Yeah, for
and
a while.
And then, you know, you sort of signed to, you know, the big bad major, you know, Virgin yeah. Records, and, you know, you kind of sort of wanted to sort of work within, didn't you?
Yeah, I think it was a complete change. It had a lot to do with me, you know, a philosophical change, if you like, me thinking that... I was slightly disappointed that indie music started to have become formulaic. Like, suddenly there was a whole way to dress, a whole way to sound, and, you know, the whole... there was suddenly indie stores cropping up, and a cartel of them around Britain, and it became, like, almost institutionalised, which was what I thought we were against in the first place. And it seemed to me what was a lot more interesting was the role that music had played in Black America in the history of the civil rights movement, also what was just kicking off with hip-hop. You know, people were coming back and playing Bambaataa and stuff for me. And so New York was the place to go. And the idea of being, like, anti-indie almost was the thing. Well, let's you know, you can continue to pretend to be inept, but if you're actually playing, you're going to learn your instrument at some point and you really want to strive to achieve something else.
All right, well, we'll continue with the story, and you arrive in New York. News and travel is on the way. It's a Scritti Politti one-hour special, and let's give people another taster of what they can expect from the new album. White Bread, Black Beer is the new Scritti album, and we're going to play a track called Snow in Sun, which is a favourite of mine. I mean, I mentioned this to you before we came on air, but it kind of reminds me a little bit of a sort of Beach Boys feel to it. Can you hear that yourself?
Well, I mean... Brian Wilson, huge influence. I mean, isn't he on everybody? You know, I went to see him at the Festival Hall when he did Smile, and that was one of my greatest evenings of my life. And he continues to inspire me. I mean, astonishing man. And so the influence is bound to kind of crop up somewhere.
Correspondence or coherence, train into town. And the sun was shining brightly, though the snow was falling lightly too. Made me think of how brave you are, and how come I have strayed so far, and why everything came apart. In my head and heart now, you will never be without me. You will never need to doubt me. There'll be something good about me soon. Like sun in the city snow, like snow in the city sun. Watching you sleep, I've been watching you dream. Should we be beset with trouble, I would never let. Looks like maybe we'll lose our home, out of pocket and all alone. I should have worked and I should have known. Seen the dark clouds coming, but you'll never be without me. I'm beside you, never doubt me. There'll be something good about me soon. Like sun in the London sun, like snow in the London sun. Determined, inessential, I am calling, I am calling you. You.
94.9 FM. BBC London.
With the headlines, I'm Elaine Park. Police are continuing to question a 16-year-old boy about the murder of Kyan Prince outside his school in North London. He was stabbed once in the chest on Thursday afternoon. Firefighters in Hertfordshire are on strike this evening in a dispute over job cuts and station closures. Around 90 members of the Fire Brigades Union walked out. Singers from across Europe are gearing up for the final tonight of the Eurovision Song Contest. 24 countries are taking part. That's the summary. More news at 8.
On 94.9 FM, this is BBC London.
London's weather and any residual showers should clear by this evening, leaving a dry, mild night with a minimum temperature of 11 degrees Celsius, that's 52 degrees Fahrenheit. Travel now and on public transport, no current problems to report, just the usual weekend closures. But on the roads, we've had reports in just now of a car fire on the M25 anti-clockwise between junction 29 for Romford and 28 for the A12 Brook Street roundabout. One lane blocked, their queues on the approach. In the city in Holborn, a serious accident has closed the A40 High Holborn westbound between Gray's Inn Road and Kingsway, which itself has blocked northbound across Waterloo Bridge. Long delays there now, with traffic being diverted via Gray's Inn Road. And the Prince's Trust concert in Tower Hill tonight means until 11 o'clock this evening, Tower Hill will be closed westbound from Tower Bridge to Southwark Bridge, with Lower Thames Street also blocked in both directions between Blackfriars Underpass and Trinity Square. So do make sure you allow yourself plenty of time if you're travelling that way tonight. Alex Thomas, BBC London, 94.9. More travel and weather just before 8.
BBC London 94.9, and it's a Scritti Politti one-hour special, and Green Gartside is my very special guest, and from all those years ago, from 1980, we think. Might be 1979 as well, but we're not going to fall out about it. That was, of course, The Sweetest Girl, which was, you know, an important song, an important single, really, wasn't it? And I guess it was kind of like a clue to the new direction, in a sense, really, wasn't it?
I started to, you know, be more open and honest about liking melody again and, like, trying to write songs that people could relate to, and I remember Madness even ended up covering that tune, which was a great, you know, great accolade, and I was chuffed to bits about that. And that was the beginning where I think my voice started to change from a kind of bit self-conscious punky to just trying to absorb other influences. Well, no, you didn't try, but they just came. Do you know what I mean? It's interesting, if you listen back to my records, my voice has changed, you know, along the way quite a bit, and that's just through the influence of different singers. You didn't consciously ever, which is weird because it started off, you know, the influence being Robert Wyatt and then Michael Jackson and all sorts of strange people
that have all ended up, all gone into the mix.
Yeah, exactly.
What would have been the sort of, you know, reaction to, you know, the new direction from, you know, people like, you know, Tom and you know, I mean, I remember Matthew at the time as well.
Yeah.
Was he keyboards as manager?
He was just anything that needed doing.
Right.
Cooking was his specialty. I mean, he's a great chef. There's a lot of people, I mean, I didn't really... Subsequently, it's come to light. I think there are a lot of people around Rough Trade and things like that, which was our label, that were kind of faintly appalled, I think, about the sellout and about the going for manufactured pop and all that kind of thing. It's which I guess was kind of the intention, really. I was quite happy to appall people. You know, there was a kind of feel that we had some kindred spirits, I think, in a way, with bands like the Human League and Heaven 17, other bands that started off, you know, on the whole indie thing. And then deciding that what was much more subversive was to make pop music, in inverted commas, than to just carry on making indie records.
Yeah.
So that was the game, anyway. And it was kind of like a game.
And what about that period as far as music was concerned? You know, the kind of quality of that music as well. I mean, you know, were you a fan of you know, what else was kind of sort of happening at that time? Or I mean, did you sort of see them as sort of kindred spirits? Or were you kind of sort of out there on your own, doing your own thing?
I'd kind of gone off to New York I went to New York first in the, I think, 78, 79, and I'd gone to, like, the Mud Club and seen relatively early hip-hop stuff, and that was a great passion. So as soon as I could move back there, I did. And so it kind of developed for me in a slightly different way, because from the Human League and the other guys that were doing it in the UK, because I was very keen to be in the States doing it.
What was it like for this, you know, for this kind of kid from South Wales, you know, being at these clubs? You know, because New York back in the early 80s, certainly from you know, my point of view in London, seemed such a vibrant place. I mean, you know, not only all the wonderful kind of early rap records being made by African Bambaataa and, you know, the funky 4+1.
Yeah.
And, you know,
Run DMC, of course.
That's right. And you know, but also all of that, you know, very exciting, you know, R&B soul music as well.
Yeah, there was
You had all those wonderful radio stations like WBLS and, you know, Power, I think, 1BR. I used to get a friend of mine in New York to send me cassettes of the radio stations in New York just to play them in the car when I was driving around London.
It was interesting because there was, at that time, they used to have a kind of thing called urban radio stations, which would play a mix. I mean, you could hear Run DMC, then you could hear a Scritti record. And it was really odd when we started doing... Because we wouldn't play live, they used to drag us around the whole of the States to visit radio stations, and they'd stick you in a stretch limo, and you'd go, like, downtown LA, Watts, whatever, to a radio station surrounded by barbed wire that was black station, you know, and then you'd drive up through the Hollywood Hills to some, you know, air-conditioned, and the distinction couldn't be greater. I can remember when I first went into an American record company, the fact they had black A&R, white A&R at either end of the corridor, and different people working, you know, the whole thing, I just wasn't prepared for that. But there was that moment when the urban thing kicked off where there was a lot of interaction. You know, there was, we used to get some props from hip hop people, and I still do, you know, from some people in the hip hop community who liked the records we made back in the day. And not only, it wasn't only hip hop that was influencing us, it was also, you know, I can remember bands like Shalimar and a whole slew of like really beautifully produced and crafted R&B and, along with the Quincy Jones stuff and everything, that was a great era.
And of course, Miles Davis, you got to hang out with as well, didn't you?
Yes.
He played trumpet on
Patty.
Was it on Patty?
Yeah. He covered Perfect Way. Yeah,
he did. That's it. Yeah.
That's how that happened.
What, you know, how did that all come about, and what was that like?
That's pretty odd. But no, somebody rang up and said, "Did you realise that Miles had covered one of your songs?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Yeah, well, he'd quite like to meet you," and all the rest of it. So I ended up going to his apartment a couple of times and hanging out with him. And then the song I was working on at the time was Oh Patty, which in fact, yeah, I remember writing that in Islington. I can picture the room. And and so we just thought, well, we'll ask Miles to come in and play on it. I was expecting him to come to roll in Mobb Deep, you know, surrounded by guys and whatever. And he came totally alone, just him and his trumpet. I remember he's wearing a hairnet. That was an interesting thing. He was very, very concerned about his appearance, Miles, right up to the very end. But he's a very, very suave and dapper guy. And that was an amazing time in the studio with him. I mean, I found it was interesting because he was quite a nervous man in a way, quite shy. And I remember going to his apartment overlooking Central Park and him showing me all his paintings and playing me tapes of his live gigs and stuff. And he had all these drawings out on the floor. And I was invited to choose one. And I really couldn't. I mean, what if I chose the wrong one? Do you know what I mean? Like, so, but... he was fantastic, and he was a lot, I think people thought that he wasn't really aware of, you know, that he kind of lost it towards the end, but the Miles that I met and knew briefly was a very, very together man, and he used to ring me up. We were supposed to do some more work together, and then sadly he passed.
Mm.
So.
Well, some lovely memories to have.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic, yeah.
Well, let's give them people another example of what they can expect from the excellent new Skrittipolity album, White Bread, Black Beer. It's out on the 29th of this month, and the Boom Boom Baps song is going to be a single at some point in June. But I want to play this tune, Dr. Abernathy next. Green, can you tell us a little bit about this one?
Whoa, blimey. Not having listened to it since I made it, I can remember that the first half is slow and quiet, then it gets a bit rockier, then it gets, that's about as much as I can tell you about it. It's interesting, when we played the Luminaire the other day, this guy came up to me and said, Dr. Abernathy, I know what it's all about. And I thought, that's fantastic, because I don't really. And he said, I looked him up, he was Martin Luther King's doctor, wasn't he? And that's what the song's all about. And I thought, it's fantastic. You know, of course it wasn't. I mean, I didn't know that he was Martin Luther King's doctor, but from now on, I think that's going to be my story. So...
I wonder how I'm feeling now. I don't suppose I should have chosen that star. How much is enough? I don't quite hear the dime drop, the buck stop, or the bell. I stole a glance at circumstance. It's way too big for them to figure outside. In the exercise yard, the three winds blow, the deer jumps. It won't be long, round and round. Punks jump up to get beat down. All the days of my life, love. You were here. You wanted heroin, gave him beer. Dr. Abernathy called to see if you were in. started in July. Another reference for me to try. Dr. M and Becky called to see if you were here. The news is terrible, you're in the clear. Susie's like a toony, the Isle of Miniver.
So long, but I know.
Danny, Hannah, Rabbit, Skinta, Rapper, little baby. And he took her to the Jersey Shore. For methamphetamine, for volunteers. Dr. M and Nicky called to see if you were in. You wanted licorice for my sins. Dr. M and Nicky, the Isle of Miniver.
So long, I know.
I'll start again on Saturday and finish in July. A look of wonderment, I wonder why. Call to see if you were here. The news is terrible, you're in the clear. Susie's like a toony, the Isle of Miniver.
So long, but I know.
Danny, Hannah, Rabbit, Skinta, Rapper, little baby. And he took her to the Jersey Shore. Please don't go away, I'd love for you to stay too long.
BBC London 94.9 and Green Gartside from Skritti Politti, my very special guest, and celebrating the release of the new album from the band, which is released on the 29th of this month, White Bread, Black Beer. And there's another example of what you can expect, the sumptuous sounding Dr. Abernathy. I guess we have to kind of sort of really fast forward now and sort of bring it up to speed, because unfortunately time has kind of caught up with us. But you kind of came back to the UK, didn't you? Lived in Wales for a while on your own.
I did. I was kind of despairing of the music industry then, so I kind of severed all my ties, professional and personal, don't you know, and took off and lived on my own in a cottage in Wales, which was very nice.
What was that like? I mean,
it was, you know, it's great for the first 5 years, and then you start to go a bit bonkers, I guess, you know, and as lovely as playing darts in a pub, which is my great passion when I was down there, and, you know, walking around the hills and everything, I really did start to miss London particularly. And my sister was still living in London, and she said she had a flat she wanted to rent out. So she said, come on, help me out and move to Dalston. So, which is what I did, and I'm very, very glad that I did, yeah.
Well, what's been the sort of knock-on effect then, Green? You know, because, you know, and you coming back to London and sort of Hackney and Dawson in particular, and, you know, becoming part of that community, really, which you have done. You know, I mean, what's been the knock-on effect as far as, you know, you're concerned, both personally and also, you know, your music as well?
Well, I think what it meant was there was a great sense of community in Dalston, which I hadn't really experienced for a long time. And you know, I got to, you know, talk to your neighbours and, like, really, it's a fantastic place. And my local pub there's lots of cool people there, and that's where I kind of recruited a new band from people that weren't particularly skilled players, mainly young, you know, just great people. And you kind of meet them over a pint and talk about music, and you had some shared interests. They end up coming back to your place. You know, I play them some of the songs that I'd recorded for the album, and before I knew it, I had a six-piece band together. All from, with the exception of the drummer, they all come from the same pub, and the drummer comes from the pub up the road. So, it's fantastic.
A great pub band.
A real pub band, yeah.
And, of course, you know, back on Rough Trade Records now as well. So, I mean, how did that come about?
I think it was Jeff Travis, just the head of Rough Trade, got in touch and
Completely out of the blue?
Completely out of the blue, yeah. And I think he basically said, you know, I think you make great music, but I think you need my help. And I was only too happy to say, yes, please, you know, that would be lovely. And so, yeah, it's working out really, really nicely.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm happy to say.
And let's talk about this album. I mean, you know, we're kind of sort of giving people, you know, examples of what they can expect from it. But it's all been recorded in a back room in your flat in Hackney.
Yeah, which is a great way to work.
Right.
You know, because I'm not the most, well, no, what am I? I'm kind of lazy, really. And it's fantastic, you know, as anyone, the whole new technology has made things like this possible that you can roll out of bed. And
are you quite a technical sort of boffin
yourself? I can get by, but I do have an engineer called Andy who lives next door but one, which is handy. So I can ring him up and say, you know, I want to do some vocals, can you pop round? And he comes round in his pyjamas, job done, you know. And we can walk the dog and then go to the pub again. So it all works out very nicely.
And what about, you know, what about the songs? I mean, you know, the lyrics as well. Mm. I mean, you know, how's that sort of, you know, evolved, mutated over the years? I mean, you've been doing this since the, you know, the kind of sort of late 70s. I mean, yeah. Can you see any kind of sort of changes, or do you leave that for other people to pick up on?
I think, well, I'd hope the lyrics have got better. I think maybe there were some good lyrics in the beginning and some not so great lyrics in the middle period, but it's kind of always trying to mix up what you'd broadly call the personal and political. I mean, that sounds really naff, but it's trying to address bigger issues through the little things in your life, and that does sound totally naff, so I'm going to shut up about them now.
And what about the album itself as well? I mean, have you kind of surprised yourself with this record, Green, as well?
I guess the fact that I made it alone is like, which is something that I never thought I would do, particularly after the experience of being in America with working with such great musicians. And I never was, you know, I came from punk, so great musicianship was never something I acquired. But over the years, you know, you've kind of surprised how much you have learnt and how much all that time spent watching great players, you really do. I can remember when I first went to New York and was in a room full of musicians and they were talking about sitting back on the beat, and I had no idea what they were talking about. You know, the way that in like R&B, you kind of slightly lay back a guitar against the drum or something. And I guess, you know, you learn all this stuff along the way, and then finally the technology allows you to do it yourself.
Well, keep learning. It's lovely to see you again.
Thank you, Gary.
Hopefully there won't be such a gap.
Yep, definitely not.
Next time. But it really is lovely to see you. And as I said, the album, which is fantastic. I mean, one of my favourites so far of 2006, White Bread, Black Beer, the new album from Skritti Pilitti, out on the 29th of this month. And we're going to end with the lovely Road to Regret. Again, the inspiration for this one, Green.
It's about, I guess, the whole thing of, you know, I used to hide away. You know, I spent a lot of time like in Wales, was really, if you don't do anything, then you can't be criticised for it. And you can't, I mean, you won't succeed as well, though. But, and it's about, if you never play your hand, then you'll never win the bet. The road's no regret.
Waiting for the time it takes for someone to forget. I'm standing on the corner of the road to no regret. Road to no regret. Oh, it's a long way to come. I could hear the voice of reason. I could see the light in the air. Waiting on the corner of the road to no regret. The road to no regret. Put your lips together, you won't get upset. Think of any number, think of any alphabet. Just another drink, just another cigarette. Standing on the corner of the road to no regret. The road to no regret. I standing on the corner of Road to No Regret. Road to No Regret. Oh, it's a long way to go. Put your lips together, you won't get upset.
Yeah.